interesting. How exactly do you make the diagnosis of migraine?
I think we need to change our perception. When a patient walks into your office complaining of a headache, think migraine first. What are the cardinal features? First and foremost, the fact that a patient's complaining about it means they have disability. If it comes and goes, that means the second point, it's episodic. And then you look for throbbing or aggravated by movement or nausea or sensitivity to light and sound. This is crucial about migraine. We have formal diagnostic criteria for clinical trials and to help us look in population about the other characteristics of migraine. And we have what we call certain red flags. What are the warning signs that it might be something else? Patient with a headache for the first time, over 55, a sudden onset headache, a change in the quality of the headache, or if the patient complains of certain neurological signs and symptoms, that's the time to worry about being something else. But most of the time, it's migraine. We have formal diagnostic criteria, and basically we look at the quality of the pain and the associated features to make a diagnosis of migraine without aura. We're looking at migraine with aura, which are these funny neurological signs and symptoms that occur before the attack. We look at the characteristics of the aura. Does it develop over a period of time? If it's too quick, it's not migraine.
I think to make it easier for physicians, a number of years ago, we developed a questionnaire to try to whittle down the time that it takes for physicians to make a diagnosis of migraine, because when they're presented with a patient, they only have 5, 7, maybe 10 minutes with that patient. There's a lot that needs to be done in that short period of time. So how can they quickly make a diagnosis? How can they get to the meat? And so what we've developed was we validated three questions. The questions are, do you have photophobia or sensitivity to light? So that's the P. Are you impaired during your headache? That's the I. And do you have nausea during your headache? That's the N. So we pin the diagnosis. If they respond positively to those three questions, 98% positive predictive value, which means you can be 98% sure that that patient has migraine. And that makes it very simple. Physicians can do that in less than a minute.
And I think it's important to emphasize that if patients meet criteria for migraine and don't have any alarming findings on their physical or neurologic examination, the overwhelming likelihood is that they have migraine. And furthermore, that special diagnostic testing or investigation is not likely to be helpful in treating that patient or managing them.
Now, what you've discussed so far, are those the only types of migraine?
No, there are lots of other different kinds of migraine, and they're rarer. There's hemiplegic migraine, where during an attack, you're weak on one side. There's retinal migraine, where you actually see funny things in one eye or the other. There's basilar migraine, where there's signs and symptoms of the back of the brain, which means you can be off balance or have signs and symptoms on both sides of your body. And then there's the complications of migraine, including status migrainosis and chronic migraine.
But 99% of the time, what physicians are going to see in practice is either migraine with aura or migraine without aura. And the aura simply refers to the neurological symptoms that about 20% of patients experience during an attack of migraine. So they may see sparks or prisms or what we call scintillations in their vision, or they may get numbness around their mouth and in their hand. But that occurs only in about 1 of 5 patients with migraine. So in general, physicians see basically migraine without aura, which is why it's sometimes difficult, as Dr. Silberstein alluded to, if they don't have those neurological symptoms, it's sometimes difficult to make the diagnosis of migraine.
And then so how do you differentiate among the different types of headache?
Two things that people always worry about are sinus headache and tension headache. What about sinus headache? It exists, but patients are sick as heck. They usually have a fever, they have pus coming out of their nose, they have pain and they have tenderness, and it lasts for days at a time, and it's always associated with an upper respiratory infection. This is unlike migraine, where you're not sick as heck, you don't have a fever, and you don't have pus coming out of your nose. The confusion is that the pain of sinus headache is localized in the sinus areas, and migraine pain is often localized in the same area. The second type of headache is tension-type headache. It's really defined by the absence of migraine features. It's dull as opposed to throbbing. It's not aggravated by movement as compared to migraine. It's on both sides of your head, and it's mild to moderate as opposed to moderate to severe.
I think if headache's bad enough for a patient to come to the doctor about it, and particularly if it's been recurrent over many years, the likelihood is that it's migraine. But Steve is right. I think, you know, a lot of patients with migraine we know are not diagnosed. Roughly half of all patients in large population surveys who have migraine by criteria tell you that they've never had a diagnosis of migraine from any kind of health professional. And beyond that, many patients who do see doctors about headache will come back with diagnoses that we know are incorrect. Sinus headache, as Steve described, is not all that common, and there are criteria for making diagnoses like that, but many patients are incorrectly diagnosed as having sinus headache when, in fact, they have migraine, or they're misdiagnosed as having tension-type headache as well. So it's important to realize that there's a large reservoir of people out there who are suffering, disabled, might benefit from treatment, but who either haven't got a diagnosis or have gotten a diagnosis that unfortunately is not correct.
My patient Pat took her to the sixth doctor until she got a diagnosis of migraine.
And the problem is, you know, a number of studies have been done where they've looked at patients who have either self-diagnosed, they've diagnosed themselves with sinus headache, or their physicians have diagnosed them with sinus headache, and 90% of them have migraine. And as Steve alluded to earlier, the problem is one of guilt by location. So the pain is often in the sinus area, but in tension-type headache, migraine, about 75 to 80% of patients will have pain in the back of the head and in the neck. And whenever pain goes to the neck, physicians want to make the diagnosis of tension-type or muscle contraction headache. So it's guilt by location for both disorders, and it's guilt by association, too. Sometimes during a migraine attack, a patient might get a little watering out of the nose, a little watering out of the eye. They may feel a little stuffy, and so logically, they're going to make their own diagnosis of sinus headache. So it's guilt by location and guilt by association.
Well, Dr. Dodick, what causes migraine?
Well, you know, basically what I tell patients, because patients often ask that same question, migraine is generally a familial inherited disorder of the brain, not of the blood vessels, but of the brain. And the way I explain it to patients, you know, you've inherited this condition, and I liken it to a problem with a brake. Really what happens is pathways or networks in the brain become activated. And when these pathways or networks become activated, there's a pathway that causes pain in the head, and there's the pathway that makes people very sensitive to things in the environment like light, noise, odors. It's not that anybody turned up the light or turned up the noise or are producing bad odors, but they just become hypersensitive. So these pathways become activated. Now, why does that happen? I tell patients that think about a brake. Normally, these pathways are supposed to be inhibited, right? And so think about a brake that's pressed to the floor. Patients with migraine, they have a twitchy brake. So sometimes that brake is lifted off. It may be lifted off if they drink a little alcohol or if they eat certain foods like chocolate. It may be lifted off if it's a woman and she's menstruating or if that person's under a particular amount of stress. So are things in the external and internal environment that may lift that brake off. Sometimes the brake may lift off for no reason. Maybe when you let your guard down, like you're sleeping, you can develop a migraine attack. Or with the letdown from stress. So someone who's studying for exams and cramming, it's over, they're finally ready to let their hair down, have a good time, they get a migraine attack. And so they start to understand that brake concept. And then it helps me when I explain treatment to them, because the treatment is really meant to reinforce that brake, to reapply that brake so that we stop those pathways from becoming activated.
One of the ways of looking at migraine is there are nerves that surround the lining of the brain, the meninges, and the blood vessels, the so-called trigeminal nerve. The trigeminal nerve is chock full of chemicals like substance P, calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP, and neurokinin A. What we believe is that during a migraine attack, the trigeminal nerve becomes activated, these chemicals come out, and the lining of the brain becomes inflamed and irritable, and this produces the throbbing pain of migraine and its aggravation by movement. Very simple analogy. Exactly the same thing happens in the skin during hives. Nerve terminals relieve chemicals, changing the sensitivity of those nerves is simply touching it. This is what happens during a migraine attack. When those nerves become excited, they send impulses to the brainstem, to the major relay nucleus that sends pain to the brain. When that happens, these nerve impulses continue to impinge upon that and go on and on and on, and this nerve center in the brain becomes excited too. This is called central sensitization. That's why patients with migraine tell you they can't touch their hair, They can't touch their skin. They can't put on jewelry. Because when you get central sensitization, the nerves in the skin respond differently. This is called allodynia. That's why patients with migraine are more sensitive. Migraine pain begins in the lining of the brain. Nerve impulses become excited. Peripheral sensitization. Continued activation of these nerve impulses go to the brainstem. When the next relay neurons get activated, that's central sensitization, and that produces allodynia. And from a clinical point of view, that's what happens in patients who are not responsive to triptans. The longer you wait to treat, the more likely you are to have central sensitization, and that predicts triptan failure.
Yeah, I think it's helpful for patients to understand that to a large extent this is an inherited tendency and it has to do with the way that your nervous system is wired up and functions. But it's also helpful for them to realize that there are environmental or other triggers, some of which they might have control over, that can make it more or less likely that these processes will be activated. So useful, I think, in abolishing in their minds the idea that, you know, there's one thing causing my headaches, and if I could just find that one thing, then I'd be fine. It's much more helpful to give them the idea that here are things that affect the likelihood that this will happen, but there's probably no one thing that's predominant. Things, though, that patients can be helped to look for or pay attention to are alcohol or caffeine use that might be activating headache. Sometimes patients don't realize that sleep plays a big role, too much or too little. Various other things like scheduling stressful events at certain times of the month for women can make a difference in affecting their headaches, and a lot of other environmental triggers. It's helpful to encourage patients to look for some of those that might be modifiable.
Well, if we appreciate what is known about the physiology of migraine, we can begin talking about how to treat it. Pat told us about how she tried using over-the-counter medications before receiving a diagnosis of migraine.
Either I was getting pills from my mother, or I was medicating myself with the over-the-counter, like, you know, the strongest dose, strongest over-the-counter medicine I could find.
Many patients seeking medical care have already tried over-the-counter medications. Do over-the-counter medications actually work for acute migraine?
Some patients do well with over-the-counter medications, but it's important to remember that the studies looking at whether over-the-counter medications work for migraine have generally looked at patients who have mild attacks and are not vomiting. And those patients are not the typical kinds of patients who come to the office seeking medical care for headaches. So in that population, it's important to find out what they have tried before. You don't want to repeat things that have been ineffective or classes of medications that just don't work for that patient.
Yeah, and in general, by the time a patient makes it to a physician's office, by the time they drag themselves in because their attacks are severe, they've tried on average 6 over-the-counter medications. So they've exhausted that sort of first-line therapy, if you will, and that's a signal to the physician that they really need to step it up with more specific migraine medications.
Now let's focus on migraine-specific medications. Let's start with triptans. How do they work to treat migraines?
It used to be believed the migraine was a disorder of blood vessels, and the drugs like the triptans were designed to constrict blood vessels. We now know that's not true. Migraine is a disorder of the central nervous system. Dave talked about a break. I talked about this neuroinflammatory process that affects nerve endings and central sensitization. So how do triptans work? Triptans stop these nerve endings from releasing these chemicals. They stop these nerve endings from sending signals into the brain. That's how triptans work. As I mentioned earlier, these nerve endings contain substance P, calcitonin gene-related peptide, and neurokinin A. They prevent these chemicals from being released. And in addition, the triptans are specific. Why? On these nerve terminals are certain serotonin receptors, and that's where the triptans go to do their work.
It's important that physicians understand it's not just about writing the prescription for a triptan. It's educating the patient on how to appropriately use it. Taking it early, while the pain is still mild, for most patients will enhance the response and will lead them to be pain-free much faster. So it's important to set that expectation up and educate the patient on how to take them. It's also important to tell patients that there are 7 triptans. All are well established as being very effective. But the response is idiosyncratic. So if you come into my office, I really don't know what triptan you're going to respond best to. And I also don't know which triptan you're going to respond worse to. In other words, I don't know which one's going to cause side effects for you. So it's often a process of trial and error. And all oral triptans are effective. So the first decision point for me when I've decided to use a triptan is, should I use an oral triptan or should I use a non-oral formulation? And the way I ask, what I ask patients is, do you wake up with your attacks that are already severe? Do they peak very quickly, or are they associated with nausea very quickly? If they respond yes to one of those three questions, then maybe that's a patient that should have a non-oral medication, a nasal spray or an injectable. If those questions, if the patient answers no to those questions, which is the case about 70% of the time, then an oral tablet is fine, and you go through the medications until you find the one that works best for that patient.
Dr. Loader, how do you select which triptan to use? Is there good evidence for all of them?
There's good evidence from clinical trials that all of the triptans are effective in treating acute migraine. But I think even more important than the clinical trial evidence is that we now have well over a decade and a half of clinical experience using these medications. And I think some of the initial concerns that people had about cardiovascular complications and other problems really have not been borne out by that experience. And we now know that in appropriately selected patients, these drugs are not only remarkably effective, they're also remarkably safe.
Does the timing matter in regards to when you administer the medication? Can patients use them any time during a migraine?
They're effective when given at any point during a headache, but they seem to be more effective, and patients have a higher chance of getting a really good response, maybe even a pain-free response to the drug, if they take it when the headache is still mild. And often that's early in the headache for most patients. So, yeah, we encourage patients to treat early, take an adequate dose. Unfortunately, many patients delay taking the medication, or they'll try to take over-the-counter medications first. And while that may be an effective strategy for some patients, too often it's like playing Russian roulette, and it increases the chance that the patient will not get good relief ultimately and maybe have to go to the emergency department.
What about the side effects of triptans?
All drugs have issues of tolerability and safety. What do we mean by tolerability? Those are the side effects you get. What about safety? That means there's something bad that can happen to you when you take a drug, and that's the basis for contraindications. There's the so-called triptan side effects, the tingling, the funny feelings you get in your skin, which are not uncommon and go away. Some patients can feel a little bit dizzy or tired or weak. There's one side effect that's of concern to patients, because they feel this chest pressure tightness. It has nothing to do with your heart. It doesn't mean you're going to get a heart attack, but this is what scares patients, and it's extremely important that physicians tell the patients to expect that.
There are contraindications to the use of triptans. Patients who are known to have coronary artery disease, or patients who are at very high risk of having undiscovered coronary artery disease on the basis of risk factors like smoking, diabetes, male sex, or advanced age, you do have to think carefully about whether they're appropriate candidates. And triptans are contraindicated in people who have poorly controlled hypertension. So not the patient with hypertension who's well controlled on medication, unless they have other risk factors as well, but patients whose hypertension is not well controlled.